In 2018, we covered the case of Dennis Perry in season 3 of our podcast. Dennis is now serving 2 life sentences for the murder of Harold and Thelma Swain, who were shot down in the entryway of their small rural church in Waverly, Georgia, in 1985. It wasn't until 15 years later that Dennis Perry was arrested for the crime, after the case was reopened and a new investigator was brought on to solve what was, by then, Camden County's most notorious unsolved cold case. At Dennis's trial, the evidence against him consisted primarily of 2 problematic eyewitness identifications: the testimony of a woman named Jane Beaver, who claimed Dennis told her in advance of his plans to commit a murder, but who had secretly been promised $25,000 if her testimony resulted in his conviction, and a statement made by Dennis after his arrest, which police officers would describe as a confession, despite the fact not one of them had made a record of any statements Dennis made that can be described as an admission of being involved in any crime. It was on this evidence that Dennis Perry was convicted. The jury was just about to begin deliberations on whether Dennis should be executed when the prosecutor came to him with an offer. "Forfeit any right to appeal your conviction," the prosecutor told him, "and your life will be spared. Instead of the death penalty, you'll get 2 life sentences." Dennis accepted the sentencing agreement, but he has never stopped maintaining his innocence in this crime. A few months after season 3 of this podcast came to a close, Dennis's attorneys at the Georgia Innocence Project and King and Spalding filed a habeas petition on his behalf, challenging his conviction on the basis of numerous due process violations, including the prosecutor's intentional withholding of exculpatory evidence and the resulting ineffective assistance of counsel. The Attorney General's office moved to dismiss Dennis's petition, arguing, among other things, that Dennis Perry was procedurally barred from raising a challenge to his conviction because it had taken him too long to discover the state's Brady violations. As a result, the state claimed Dennis had forfeited any right to complain about it. The state's motion to dismiss has been pending before the court ever since. It was scheduled to be heard later this month, along with the merits of Dennis's habeas petition, at a hearing before the Superior Court of Coffee County, where Dennis is currently incarcerated. But all of that was before the COVID-19 pandemic happened. There are no hearings being held now, and it is unclear when Dennis's habeas petition will have a chance to come before the court. Last week, though, Dennis's attorneys filed a new motion, this time in Glynn County Superior Court, where Dennis Perry was convicted. And this time, his attorneys were not filing a habeas petition. Instead, they filed an extraordinary motion for a new trial, on the grounds that a new DNA test had been conducted in Dennis's case, and that the result of that DNA testing was so material that, had this evidence been available at the time of Dennis's original trial, the jury would have likely reached a different verdict. Hi, and welcome to Undisclosed. This is an update episode on the state versus Dennis Perry. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of A Non-Story, and I'm here with my colleagues, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, my name is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
At the end of season 3 of our podcast, I felt confident that I knew what had happened to Dennis Perry, and how it came to be that he was convicted of a crime that he had not and could not have committed. There are a lot of reasons that I think that. In fact, there are 21 episodes worth and counting. But for me, one of the most compelling reasons to believe in Dennis Perry's innocence has never needed any particular sort of investigation to uncover. Instead, it's based on one of the case's most basic facts. Because when investigators arrived at the Rising Daughter Baptist Church on the night the Swains were killed, they found a pair of glasses lying just inches from Harold Swain's body, cast on the floor amid the bullet casings and shirt buttons that were strewn about the small entryway. One of the glasses' lenses had been popped out. They were prescription glasses for someone who was extremely farsighted, and these glasses had been assembled from the pieces of 3 other glasses, combined together to make 1 working pair. The lenses of the glasses were pitted, as if they'd been worn by someone who had used them as a welder. Those glasses did not belong to Harold, and they did not belong to Thelma. and the hairs that were caught in the glass's hinges were blonde and brown. The glasses had been worn by someone who was white, and therefore not a member of anyone in Rising Daughter's African-American congregation. In my view, anyway, it is painfully, blindingly obvious how those glasses got there. They were dropped by whoever killed the Swains. By the young white man with shoulder-length hair, and who, according to at least one of the witnesses, had been seen wearing glasses shortly before Harold Swain and him scuffled in the entryway. And no, we don't have direct evidence that proves the killer dropped those glasses, but as prosecutors love to tell juries, if you look outside one morning and see fresh snow on the ground, you don't need any witness to tell you that it snowed overnight. The circumstantial evidence is proof enough of that. And here, in this case, I don't need a witness to tell me that those glasses were dropped by whoever shot Harold and Thelma Swain. Or, at the very least, if those glasses were not dropped by the killer, I'm gonna need some convincing evidence that shows some other way that they got there. And for me, any explanation for who killed the Swains that does not include an explanation for how those glasses ended up there is not an explanation at all. So that's one reason that I'm confident that Dennis Perry could not have committed this crime. Because we have what are most probably the killer's glasses, and those glasses did not belong to Dennis Perry. And while those glasses themselves have gone missing somewhere along the way over the past 34 years since the Swains were killed, and are still missing today, the hairs that were found in the glasses' hinges were recovered, and in 2001, they were submitted for DNA testing, and a mitochondrial DNA profile was obtained. And that DNA did not belong to Dennis Perry either. But all of this is also why I've never been able to convince myself that this case's primary alternate suspect, a man from Florida named Donnie Barentine, is actually responsible for killing the Swains. Because those glasses and that DNA didn't come from Donnie Barentine either.
As we discussed in episode 9, the case against Donnie Barentine is flawed for much the same reasons that the case against Dennis Perry was flawed. And in many ways, the evidence against Donnie Barentine is a mirror image of the evidence against Dennis Perry. For both, the evidence of their guilt is based on statements from witnesses who claim they heard confessions, but who had serious credibility problems, as well as some eyewitnesses who identified each of them as the man they'd seen that night. That is, the same eyewitnesses who identified Perry had both also identified Barentine as the young white man they'd seen in church that night, and made both identifications with equal confidence. Likewise, many of the weaknesses in the case against Dennis Perry are the same weaknesses in the case against Donnie Barentine. Both Perry and Barentine had alibis for the day in question. Both had been working at jobs that were a good 4 to 5 hours away from Camden County, Georgia. And of course, neither Perry nor Barentine wore glasses.
And as we've discussed before, there are a lot of reasons to think that Donnie Barentine may not provide a convincing answer to the question of who is actually guilty of this crime. On Undisclosed, our focus is on wrongful convictions and how the criminal justice system can end up getting things wrong. Sometimes that does involve looking at other suspects in a case, as alternative suspects often impact the trajectory of cases against wrongfully convicted defendants. Suspects in a case remain in the periphery of what happened to the defendant who was ultimately convicted and outside the scope of what we focus on Undisclosed. In this episode, though, we're going to do something a bit different. Our focus is not going to be on the case against Dennis Perry. Instead, we're going to look at the evidence for who is actually responsible for the murder of Harold and Thelma Swain.
In broad terms, the suspects in this case fall into three general categories. The first category is what we'll call the Brantley County crowd. Brantley County is the county directly to the north of Camden. It's a rural county, more rural than Camden even. But in this case, even though the crime took place in Camden County, it seems like all roads end up leading to Brantley County somehow. Donnie Barentine falls under this category of suspect. Brantley County is where he stayed when he was up in Georgia, and his cousin Greg's place in a little community called Waynesville. But the Brantley County suspects go far beyond just the Barentines. Brantley is also where the Morgan family lived, and law enforcement in the area knew that the Barentines and the Morgans frequently worked together as part of a drug smuggling operation that ran drugs up from South and Central America up to ports and airstrips in Southeast Georgia. At some point in the mid-1990s, someone in the Camden County Sheriff's Office typed up a list of suspects for further scrutiny. It's a long list. There are 71 names on it in all. And a full 15% of those suspects are various members of the Morgan family. It's possible that has something to do with Jeff Cottrell, the witness who implicated Donnie Barentine in the Swain murders. Cottrell's story was that Barentine had been running around with some blonde-headed friend of his, and the two of them had confessed to the church murders. Cottrell didn't know the blonde-headed man's name, but said he wore glasses. In 2001, after Dennis Perry's arrest, but before his trial, Camden County Sheriff's Deputy Dale Bundy and GBI agent Ron Rhodes went down to Florida to interview Jeff Cottrell. And during that interview, Agent Rhodes asked Cottrell about his blonde-headed guy and where Cottrell had seen him.
All right. Well, the guy that you said was with Donnie when he was bragging about that shooting on the blonde-headed guy. Uh-huh. Do you know if he lived in Georgia? Or was he from down here? Or
he had lived in Georgia because
Donnie. Seen him up there at Morgan Hill.
I seen him up there at Morgan Hill, and plus when we went to Zebby Morgan's, that was the second time I ever seen a blonde-headed guy, and the last time I seen him.
In the interview, you can hear Bundy jump in and answer Agent Rhodes' question before Cottrell even gets a chance to. Up there on Morgan Hill, Bundy says, and Cottrell confirms it.
When I talked to Deputy Dale Bundy in 2018, I asked him about all the Morgan suspects that were listed in the case file to try and pinpoint the origins of all this interest in Brantley County.
But there was a bunch of people called the Morgans who are ne'er-do-wells. And rumor had it that one of them had said something about knowing about this murder. Ron Rhodes and I went over and dealt with those idiots for like 3 nights. And again, it ended up being a kind of a dead-end thing.
There are a lot of Morgans in the file. Like it's like a whole family, I guess.
Yeah.
So you're just trying to figure out which one may have said it, or do you know what the rumor came from?
I don't know. I don't. That was a long time ago. Yeah. I'm not trying to hide anything from it.
Bundy told me that he no longer remembers what this rumor about the Morgans was, or where it came from, or why it was so important at the time. And, as with so much in this case, any reports that were ever made about this rumor about the Morgans has long since disappeared, so there's nothing to go on there. But assuming Bundy's memory is right, there was something about the Morgans, some kind of tip they got called in or some kind of lead they received, that caused Bundy to put in some serious time trying to chase it down.
The second category of suspects in this case are the lookalikes, the men who looked exactly like the composite image that had been prepared by the church witnesses, at least according to whoever it was that had called their names in to the police. This is easily the biggest of the three suspect categories. In the case file, there are dozens and dozens of them listed as suspects, and over the years, significant investigative resources were spent looking into them further. But for most of these suspects, anything that linked them to the crime beyond their physical appearance was tenuous at best. Usually nothing more than rumor and innuendo, or maybe the fact someone had seen them with a .25 caliber gun at one time. And given how many men out there are apparently dead ringers for that composite image, it doesn't even seem like having a resemblance to the composite should have been enough to get you on the suspect list at all. Dennis Perry was a Category 2 suspect, or at least that's why he was initially added to the suspect list. His neighbor had called in his name to the police in 1988, claiming, quote, his physical makeup was very similar to the composite of the assailant in the homicide. There wasn't any real reason beyond that to think he might have had anything to do with the shootings at Rising Daughter. And it wasn't until 1998 when Bundy spoke to Jane Beaver and heard her story about Dennis confiding in her about his plans to kill Harold Swain that Dennis Perry joined the third category of suspects.
That third and final category of suspects is what we'll call the good leads. The suspects for whom there were good, concrete reasons to think they might have been involved in the Swain's murder. The suspects who had been identified as suspects for reasons more than just their physical appearance. For reasons that make you stop and think, oh yeah, that guy really needs to be checked out. And actually, despite the fact this was an open case for 15 years and had literally thousands of tips called into it, the list of good leads isn't all that long. Maybe a dozen names in all. And when Susan asked Bundy if he'd ever seen any leads in this case besides Dennis Perry that had ever caught his interest, he was only able to think of one.
Any leads that caught your interest other than Dennis? That...
Other than the guy on the motorcycle, which I forget who called about that and says, hey, you need to take a look at this guy, and I found out about him, which wasn't hard to do. I think it was in Kansas City, and I called the Kansas City DA. She says, oh, yeah, I know about this guy. He was actually, after he got out of the hospital, he went to prison. But he was hospitalized, wrapped up like a mummy from head to toe at that time.
The suspect that Bundy is talking about here had been called in by someone who had some detailed and compelling information about why he should be looked at as a suspect. It was definitely a lead worth checking out. Though, once again, all the paperwork that documented Bundy's work here is mysteriously missing from the case file. So I don't know what he received exactly from Kansas that made him rule this guy out. But from the records that I was able to find, Bundy seems to have been right. The suspect had been in a horrible fire in Kansas not long before the Swains were killed. And even if by some miracle he'd been able to leave the hospital and travel down to Georgia, it seems impossible that not a single witness of the church would not have noticed his fresh scarring. And then there was the California suspect, for instance. He too was called in by someone who had detailed and compelling reasons to think that he might have killed the Swains. Original case investigators, Deputy Butch Kennedy and Agent Joe Gregory, even flew all the way out to California to talk to people about him. And all of what they heard there seemed really, really promising. But then they talked to the suspect's eye doctor and learned that although he wore glasses, his prescription was essentially the exact opposite of the glasses found at Rising Daughter. Where the glasses found in the church were for someone who was farsighted, this suspect was nearsighted. So it couldn't have been him either. Most of the suspects on the good leads list ended this way. They were good potential suspects, yes, but there were pretty good reasons for ruling them out. But not all of the good leads ended this way. There were a couple of good suspects who had been ruled out, yet for reasons that didn't seem quite so good. For instance, there was one suspect who'd been ruled out because he passed a polygraph, which can in no way be considered a valid basis for ruling out a suspect. That alone instantly put that guy back on my own mental list of possible suspects. And then there was this other suspect. A suspect who, on paper, looked real good. The kind of suspect that makes you say, OMG, when you see the summary of it. No, seriously, that's actually the first thing that Dennis Perry's attorney at GIP said to me when she got to his case file and saw the records about him for the first time. That suspect was a guy named Eric Sparr. But here's the thing. Sparr wasn't just a Category 3 suspect. He was, unsurprisingly, also a Category 2 suspect. In fact, a version of the composite was done up to match Sparr's facial hair. And, yeah, he could be another one of the dozens of dead ringers who looked just like that drawing. But he was also a Category 1 suspect who lived in Brantley County, in Waynesville, just a stone's throw away from the Morgans and Barentines. And the list of possible reasons to be interested in Sparr as a suspect only grows from there.
If you listen to Season 3 and don't remember Eric Sparr, don't worry. It wouldn't have been hard to miss. He's the only suspect besides Donnie Barentine who got identified by his name, but he was mentioned only briefly. Technically, Eric Sparr had nothing to do with the story of how Dennis Perry came to be convicted. It's not even clear his defense attorneys even knew about him. His name never came up in the context of their investigation. But his name was known to both the original case investigators and to Dale Bundy, who reopened the case in 1998. As we discussed in Episode 7, Eric Sparr became a suspect after his ex-wife's family contacted Camden County Sheriff's Deputy Butch Kennedy. Eric Sparr had been making threatening phone calls to his ex-wife's family for months, and they were finally able to record one of these calls. In the recording, Eric Sparr said, quote, I'm the motherfucker that killed the two black people in that church, and I'm going to kill you and the whole damn family if I have to do it in church. And yeah, in case you're wondering, the word Eric Sparr used wasn't black people. On March 10th, 1986, one day short of a year from the murders at Rising Daughter, Deputy Kennedy and Agent Gregory met with Assistant DA John Johnson, and the decision was made to get a search warrant on Sparr. The supporting affidavit for the search warrant described the tape recording of Sparr's admissions and laid out the other evidence against him. The list included the following. Sometime during the week of March 11, 1985, Sparse then-wife Emily Head saw him leave home in the morning in dark clothing and then come back the next day in a white t-shirt, and he frequently wears a pair of lizard-skin boots, matching witness descriptions of what the killer wore. Another thing is that sometime during that same week, Spar lost a pair of glasses that he'd made by assembling parts of three other pairs of glasses. When Emily was given a lineup of glasses that included the glasses from the church, she picked out the pair found at Rising Daughter. Also, Spar worked as a welder, and in March of 1985, he had shoulder-length brown hair and piercing blue eyes, and his description matched that given by witnesses from Rising Daughter. And finally, Spar had a documented history of assaulting and threatening a person of color.
The search warrant was carried out at Spar's father's house in Glynn County, but nothing of interest was found, and interest in Spar seems to have fizzled out. The GBI's case file shows that a few days later, Agent Joe Gregory had a conversation with a man named Donald A. Mobley, Eric Spar's supervisor at a Winn-Dixie over in Brunswick, where, according to the report, Spar worked as a stock boy. The supervisor said he'd get Spar's time cards from corporate. A couple weeks later, Mobley called back. According to the GBI report, Motley said the work records showed that Spar worked all evening on the night of the murder, from 3.06 p.m. to 6.41 a.m. And Motley said, people who worked with Spar that night remember him being there. So after that, Spar disappeared from the case file for 12 years. He didn't reappear in it again, not even in the typed up list of 71 suspects until 1998, when Deputy Dale Bundy was on the now reopened case. GBI agent Ron Rhodes got a call from a Glynn County officer, putting him in touch with Spar's second wife, the one he married after his first wife left him in March of 1985. The second wife's story, at least according to Agent Rhodes' report from when they interviewed her, is odd, but doesn't necessarily seem all that relevant. The second wife told them, according to the report, that she had once told Eric Spar, "You could have killed those people in Camden County," and Spar had agreed, saying, quote, "Yeah, I could have killed those people." Which doesn't sound much like a confession, really. And by that point, Deputy Bundy was already certain that he knew who had killed the Swains. And it wasn't Eric Spar. It was Dennis Perry. So the second wife's story was that she had once accused her husband of the murders, and he had agreed with her that he could have done it. Or at least, that's what her story was according to the GBI report. But when Susan asked Dale Bundy about it in 2018... Bundy remembered things a bit different.
And then there was a guy over in Charlton County that claimed he killed the Swains, and his wife called up here and says, "Yeah, I think I know who did it. My husband said he went over there and blew their heads off with a shotgun." Well, that's not what happened at all. So what he was trying to do was scare his wife, which this guy did on a regular basis.
When Susan was speaking to Bundy, it had been 20 years since he had interviewed the second wife, and it makes sense that his memory of these events wouldn't be perfect. For instance, Spar was over in Brantley County, not Charlton County, like Bundy had recalled. But his memory about what the second wife said is directly at odds with what's in Agent Rhodes' report. And that detail about the shotgun, that comes from nowhere that we can find. And when Susan asked Bundy about Spar in another interview the following day, Bundy's memory about what that second wife had actually said remained the same.
Eric Spar.
Yeah, I think he's the one that said he shot him with a shotgun or something.
He's a white supremacist.
That sounds like him, the one that said he blew their heads off with a shotgun.
When our series on Dennis Perry's case came to a close at the end of 2018, Eric Spar remained a subject of interest in the continuing investigation into the Swain case, but he was far from the only person I still had questions about. Still, at some point along the way, it's fair to say that he became more of a focus. In my investigation cheat sheet for the case, where I kept a summary of the state of the investigation and laid out leads that were left to be followed, Spar was not the only name listed there, but I had him marked as the person who, if I were suddenly granted the magic power to choose one person in the world to DNA test in this case, he'd probably be my pick. And there were a lot of reasons for that. Yes, Spar had an alibi, but an underwhelming one. After all, is an overnight stock boy job really the kind of job where your coworkers are going to recall and confirm that on a specific day, over a year before, that yeah, you were there for your shift at the grocery store, all 16 hours of it, and never left? And is it really the kind of job where you'd have a nearly 16-hour shift in the first place? And then there were the repeated confessions to his ex-wives that had never been adequately explained, especially in regards to what Emily Head, his first wife, had told the police back in 1986. If what she told them had been true, it seemed hard to explain away, especially the part about him missing glasses. And she had correctly picked out the glasses from Rising Daughter as the ones that looked like Eric Spar's. Unfortunately, in the records left now, there are gaps about what she said and what happened, and we can't ask her about them because she was found murdered in her home in Camden County back in 2013. There were other things, too, in the case file that spoke of lost opportunities, lost leads, that might have gone somewhere if more had been done to follow them at the time. For instance, take a report made by Marjorie Moore a few weeks after the murders. Marjorie Moore had been at the church the night the Swains were killed, and when the shooting broke out, she fled with the other women into the church's back rooms, where they'd gone to call for help, only to discover that the phone line was dead. It had been cut from the outside. It was Marjorie who finally worked up the courage to go for help, arming herself with a broom and running to her car. She told investigators that as she pulled away, she saw a car she didn't recognize in the churchyard. It's possible the killer was still there when she left. And in late March, Marjorie Moore contacted the police again to tell them that she'd been receiving obscene and threatening phone calls from an unknown caller, who to Marjorie sounded like a white man. The caller said some kind of obscene things to her and then told her, quote, "You are the smarty that slipped off and got help. Watch your step." A trap was put on Marjorie's phone, but nothing seems to have come of it. And many years later, during the reopened investigation, another church witness, Cora Fisher, would tell investigators an odd and sometimes confusing story about the killer who drove past her house to stare at her. She told Bundy that, quote, "Shortly after the Unsolved Mysteries episode had aired in 1988, the suspect had driven down the road she lives on and had sat in front of her house and stared at her on two different occasions." In her deposition, she testified to something similar. I've never known for sure what to make of these statements from Marjorie Moore and Cora Fisher. I still don't. But reading through records of police reports involving Eric Spar from the past 3.5 decades, there's a pattern of behavior described there that sounds not dissimilar to what Marjorie Moore and Cora Fisher described. Because over the years, there have been plenty of people who have filed police reports about Eric Spar and his habit of calling them up and threatening to kill them, or their spouses, or their children. As described in one such report about Spar, the officer responded to a prowler call at the address listed. "When I arrived, the victim stated that she is testifying against a subject for several charges, and she thinks that he is the offender that was prowling around her house. The victim stated that she has seen the offender ride by her house several times, and he has called her several times and made threats." The thing about Spar, though, is that all the leads with him just refused to come to a dead end. For every new fact we learn, it felt like 100 new questions would be spawned from it. But this is an old case now, and many of the witnesses who might have once been able to help are now gone. And realistically, if Spar was involved, there was probably only one thing that could ever demonstrate that to a degree of certainty, and that would be DNA evidence. Which, luckily, this case happens to have. So, in the spring of last year, I had taken up a new hobby. Genealogy. Only, it wasn't my family tree I was interested in. It was Eric Spar's. And also, it wasn't his whole family tree that I was interested in. It was just the maternal branch of it. See, it seemed unlikely that Eric Spar would ever cooperate with a request for a sample of his DNA to be used for testing. But the thing is, for the kind of testing that we needed to be done here, you wouldn't actually need Spar's cooperation, because the DNA in this case isn't autosomal. It's not the kind of DNA that's unique to individuals. It's mitochondrial DNA, the kind of DNA that comes from the mitochondria in your cells, and it's not unique to you. With autosomal DNA, half of it comes from your mother and half of it comes from your father, but with mitochondrial DNA, all of it comes from your mother, or rather from the mitochondria in your mother's egg cells. Which means your mitochondrial DNA is the same as your mother's mitochondrial DNA, and the same as her mother's, and her mother's mother's, and so on. Which means that every relative related to Eric Spahr through a direct maternal line would also have the same mitochondrial DNA that he did. So, theoretically, to figure out Spahr's mitochondrial DNA profile, all I had to do was trace back his mother's 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 mother until I found whichever of his ancestors first thrived in Georgia. Turns out it was his great-great-great-great-grandmother. And then trace her daughter's daughters and so on back down until I got to the people who are still alive today. And theoretically, if all else failed, maybe one day one of those people would let us test their DNA. At least then we'd know, one way or another, what Spahr's mitochondrial DNA haplogroup was. In the end, though, it would turn out that all my genealogy research would be unnecessary, and the Georgia Innocence Project would find a much more direct way of solving this particular problem. Undisclosed and the Georgia Innocence Project aren't the only ones who've been looking into the Swain case. Last year, a reporter from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution spent significant time down in Camden County reporting on this case.
Yes, I'm Joshua Sharp. I'm a reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. I cover crime and criminal justice. I try to focus on the criminal justice part as much as I can, you know, working on, you know, how people are treated by systems of power in the state of Georgia.
Josh is from Southeast Georgia and actually grew up not at all that far from Camden County.
I'm interested in all of Georgia, but Southeast Georgia has a special place in my mind and heart. And anytime I get to cover those communities down there, it's exciting for me, for one, because, you know, I get a free trip home to visit. But I also get, you know, to highlight cases and people from a part of the state that where the media has shrunk a lot in the past 10 years.
Last year, Josh began looking into the Dennis Perry case.
I heard about your podcast, and I listened to your podcast, and I thought, and at the same time, I'd been, you know, looking for story ideas, and this seemed like a hell of a case for a story. And, you know, it seemed, you know, based on what you all found, it seemed that there were a lot of different things that I could explore and a lot of questions that I could ask.
Josh began digging into the case as well. There are no shortage of questions in this case that remain unanswered and plenty of things for him to look at, but one loose thread in particular stood out to him.
And the thing, after listening to y'all's podcast and all the wild things that you discovered, the thing that stuck out to me that where there could be a little bit more looking was Eric Spahr. You know, y'all mentioned Eric Spahr on the podcast, obviously. And I was wondering, you know, why would this person allegedly tell his first wife that he committed these murders and then seemingly strongly suggest to his second ex-wife, years later that he had been involved in the murders? And I knew that he had an alibi, but, you know, I know that sometimes, you know, things aren't quite what they seem.
And that wasn't the only question raised by the investigation into Spahr.
What I wonder about is what about what we don't know? And, you know, what are the things that we don't know about why Spahr was dropped as a suspect by both investigators?
Mm-hmm.
We don't really know why Kennedy and Gregory dropped him as we know that he was dropped by Kennedy and Gregory because he had an alibi, but we don't know if they had any other reasons.
There's a lot we don't know about what happened with Spahr or why both sets of investigators were so quick to dismiss him from the case. But from interviews with original case investigator GBI agent Joe Gregory and the reopened case investigator Deputy Dale Bundy, it seems that both sets of investigators may have shared a common assumption, that Spahr's confessions were less credible because they were confessions that had been made in the context of threatening the lives of women he had been married to. But that assumption, if it was the one that the investigators were making, doesn't seem to be the kind of assumption that can bear the weight that was being put onto it. So Josh Sharp began investigating Eric's bar as well. And eventually, he was able to speak to him.
Spar and I had spoken on the phone, and he told me that he did not kill the Swains.
I hope y'all find out who actually did it. I had nothing to do with this. I want it to stay where it is, gone.
And he told me that he had never even been to the church.
You know, I don't even know where the church is. Even though I'm from over there and I know the area, I've never been to the church. Don't know where it is, don't care to.
He told me that he never told anyone that he killed the Swains.
Well, there was someone else who also said that you told them you did it. But I'd just like to say...
Let me tell you something. I've never said that, nor would I say that.
Okay.
Nor do I condone anybody killing anybody, except maybe to, you know, protect their own life.
Right.
On this last point, about whether he had ever told his ex-wife that he'd done the murders, Eric Spar's story would eventually change some.
And another time, he conceded that he had... that he had said that he killed the Swains, but he suggested that he was lying about it. And he told me that he was a stupid young kid just trying to scare his wife.
Josh had a few calls with Spar, but before too long, the calls came to a sudden end.
Another day, he called me and he said that, you know, he sounded rattled in this phone call when he called me. He said that his mother had just told him that an investigator had come to the house and taken a couple of her hairs.
Spar was actually calling up to accuse Josh of taking his mother's hairs, but Josh hadn't even known what Spar was talking about at this time, because it hadn't been him who'd come to Spar's door. It had been an investigator who was working on behalf of the Georgia Innocence Project. Spar lives with his mother in Brantley County, and the investigator had knocked on his door, but Spar hadn't been home, and his mother had answered instead. So the investigator explained to Spar's mother why he was there, and asked if she'd be willing to give a few of her hairs.
And this was, the investigator told the mother that this was to do a DNA test related to the Rising Daughter murders. And I did not get to speak to Eric very long that day, but one thing that he said to me that really stands out is he said,
"This DNA will prove that I didn't do it, and you'll have your answer."
The Georgia Innocence Project sent the hairs from Spar's mother to the same laboratory that had done the original testing back in 2001 on the hairs from the glasses at Rising Daughter. 1 month later, an answer came back, as explained in Dennis's recently filed extraordinary motion for a new trial.
Based on its analysis, the laboratory determined that it can exclude, with 99% confidence, 99.6% of the population of North America as being a contributor of the hairs found on the glasses at the scene. But Eric Spar cannot be excluded. In other words, Mr. Spar falls within the 0.4% of the general population that cannot be excluded as a contributor of the DNA on the glasses that were found inches from the victims at the crime scene and are believed to belong to the Swains killer.
The mitochondrial DNA found in the glasses from Rising Daughter is not unique to Spar or to his mother. But as mitochondrial haplogroups go, it's also not a common one. The population database used by the lab to reach this result had DNA samples from 12,386 people in North America. Of those 12,386 people, only 35 of them had shared Spar's haplogroup. Shortly after the Georgia Innocence Project filed its motion in Glynn County, Josh called Eric Spar again.
Yeah, I needed to speak with him before I published. I wanted to get his take on these DNA results. And so I gave him a call, and he, first of all, he told me that he did not want to talk, but I told him I had something that I needed to tell him, and he said, okay. And I told him that the DNA test was a match, that the hairs taken from his mother matched the hairs found on a pair of glasses near the bodies. And Eric told me that he wasn't missing a pair of glasses. And I told him that his ex-wife, Emily, had told the police that he had a pair like the pair that was found inches from the Swains' bodies. And he said that he didn't know what they told him. Or he said that he didn't know what Emily told the police. And he said again that he wanted me to leave him alone, and then he hung up. And that was about it. It was a very short conversation. Some of the other ones had been a little bit longer.
here's what else I can say about the mitochondrial DNA from the hairs found in the glasses at Rising Daughter. Remember my little SPAR family tree project? Well, here's one thing it does show. In terms of people who are related through a direct maternal line to Eric Spar, and so would have the same mitochondrial DNA profile, there were very, very few of them who were males born in the 1950s or early 1960s, and so could have been the right age to have been the unknown white man in Rising Daughter Baptist Church. And of that already small group, there were only two individuals who were still in family lines that had remained in the Camden, Brantley, or Glynn County areas: Eric Spar and his brother. And between the two of them, Eric is the only one to have repeatedly made statements implicating himself in the murder, and the only one to have mysteriously lost a pair of glasses in March of 1985. So while it's possible that there could be other men around Spar's age in the Camden County area that are members of the same mitochondrial DNA haplogroup, if there are, they wouldn't be from anyone who was a member of Spar's extended family. And there's another thing about Spar beyond the DNA. Remember his alibi for the night of the murders? Yeah, well, about that. Last year, Josh Sharp from the AJC went about tracking down the man who had verified his alibi. Donald A. Mobley, Spar's manager at the Winn-Dixie.
And Donald A. Mobley said in the report that when Gregory first called, Mobley said that he would have to check and get Spar's time cards from corporate, apparently because it had been a whole year since the time of the murders. A couple weeks later, Mobley calls back and says, "Hey, I figured it out. Here's what time Spar worked. He worked from the afternoon until early the next morning, which would have included the time that that the murders took place." And he also said that he had talked to other people who were working that night and who remembered Spar being at work that night.
I remember the first time I started looking at this, like the part that says to me is the hours. It is 3:06 p.m. on the 11th to 6:41 a.m. on the 12th. And that would include the time of the murders, which is like just before 9 that evening. But that's like a 15, 16 hour shift at a grocery store. And
it seems like a long shift. I've never been a stock boy, so I don't know how unusual that is or if it is or not, but it seemed to me to be a long shift, yeah.
It's an incredibly long shift. Like, this is it's a Winn-Dixie, not an oil rig.
For all I know, though, it is possible that employees at Spar's Winn-Dixie did work those kind of hours all the time. If that is the case, there's at least one person who should be able to verify it. Donald A. Mobley, the supervisor.
Yeah, and I decided to see if I could find Donald A. Mobley, and I obviously had a great deal of trouble. I couldn't find where there had ever been a Donald A. Mobley living in the Brunswick area, and I was able to, through a very very long process of trying to track down old Winn-Dixie employees, I found a couple, a married couple who had previously worked in the company, and they helped me find David Mobley. And David Mobley was the manager of that Winn-Dixie where Spar supposedly worked at the time the murders took place, according to that's what David told me. And he was firm about that, and he's since written an affidavit to that effect too for the Georgia Innocence Project. But Mobley said that he had no memory of anyone ever asking about the murders, which he thought that he would have remembered because the murders were such a huge deal. And he also had no memory of anyone ever calling to ask about Spar. Now, it's been a really long time ago. I mean, we're talking about 34 years ago. So I thought, you know, it's possible that he just doesn't remember. But I checked the personal details that were listed on the report for Mobley, you know, and I was thinking maybe they just got the first name wrong.
Yeah.
You know, maybe because Donald, he does have David, the right last name. Yeah, Donald, David, they're similar. But it turned out that none of the personal details listed, you know, social security number, date of birth, phone number, none of that stuff matched David Mobley either.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, Donald, David Mobley's middle initial isn't the same either.
And so on the, this, so to be clear, on the sheet we have from the GBI, like what it gives you, you know, ID data, Donald A. Mobley, and it has white male, has his birth date, has an address in Brunswick, a social security number, a home phone number, and a work number. And
yes, none of these things, none of those match or sound familiar to David Mobley, who mm-hmm. was the manager of the store at the time in question.
And the social security number we can know because whoever had it is dead now. It's a dead woman. It was definitely not Mobley.
Yes.
So right. That one's definitely not accurate. The birth date, was that even close?
And that woman had been dead. She died in 78.
Yeah, she'd been gone. So she's definitely not part of this. Was the birth date even close for Mobley?
No, not really. Yeah. I mean, you know, no, it wasn't.
David Mobley couldn't verify any of the other details from the GBI report and Spahr's alibi, but here's one thing he could confirm.
That David Mobley told me unequivocally, he said, I did not have an employee named Donald Mobley. So it's not like there was just some other supervisor named Donald Mobley, according to David. You know, being the manager, he feels certain that he would have known if somebody there had his same last name. And especially if it's supervisor, you know. So all of this sounded crazy to him.
If there's no Donald Mobley, then Donald Mobley couldn't have verified Spahr's alibi. And David Mobley, who was a real person, has no memory whatsoever of verifying Spahr's alibi for anyone. And while it is possible that David Mobley may have just forgotten doing so over the past 34 years, there are some things in the GBI report that seem unlikely to be explained away as due to a faulty memory.
Sometimes I have to think for a minute to remember my birthday, but I always remember it.
Yeah.
And I certainly never get it wrong. You know, I'm never going to tell you something that a birthday that is nowhere near mine. I'm not going to tell you a social that's nowhere near mine. I'm not going to tell you a phone number that's nowhere near mine. You know, on and on.
We're not talking numbers like transposed here or mixed up, right? Like it's totally different numbers.
Totally different.
Yeah. Which, you know, means that there is no one out there to verify Eric Spahr's alibi.
While the new DNA test results that link the hairs and the glasses at Rising Daughter to Spahr's mitochondrial haplogroup go a long way to helping us figure out what happened to the Swains, there are still plenty of unanswered questions in this case. Questions like, why? Why would Spahr have done this?
Both ex-wives who spoke with the police both ex-wives who spoke with the police evidently never came out and said if they had an idea of why he would have allegedly killed the Swains. The only, you know, but one thing that they both said was that he was racist, and that almost seemed to be suggesting that they thought that race could have had something to do with it. But I just don't know. No, I mean, I still have so many questions.
Given that the Swains were African-American, and that Spahr is the kind of guy who likes to post white supremacist slogans on his social media accounts, that race may have been a motivating factor in the murders is not an unreasonable hypothesis. But as an explanation for what happened, it feels incomplete, and at odds with some of the evidence that we know about how this crime was committed. But if Spahr does have answers there about why this happened, he does not seem inclined to share them. And there are other things, too, we still don't know, like plenty of other wild claims and rumors about events in Brantley County that I hope one day to get an answer to. But as for Donnie Barentine, here's at least one small thing I do feel certain of. He was not the man who dropped those glasses in Rising Daughter. Last year, while working on this case, Josh Sharp also went down to Florida and spoke to Barentine to see if he could get any answers.
You know, I mean, he said much the same as he said to you, you know, like he's always said that he didn't do it. But it was a really, you know, I think we had probably similar experience where it was just kind of a surreal, almost a surreal interview because, like, he's got roosters, you know, losing it, making all kinds of noise in the yard, and he's got dogs banging on the door of the house, and You know, he's got a sign on the front door that says something to the effect of "Wolf, three spoiled dogs live here." There's another sign that says, "All dogs welcome, humans by appointment only." One thing he said that I thought you would find funny was that he said that he could tell that you, when you were there, were trying to make him confess. But he joked that he had been he'd been down that road before, and he wasn't gonna you weren't going to get the better of him. Yeah.
So yeah. I talked to Barentine and told him about the DNA, and you know what he told me about you?
What did he say?
He thought that you might be a cop. I had to assure him you were indeed a reporter.
Are you kidding me?
Nope. He was like, yeah, someone else came down here talking to me about it. Said he was a reporter, but you know, that's what they say sometimes. I'm like, who is they? And he's like, it's what investigators say. And I'm like, no, he's really a reporter. And he's like, are you sure? I'm like, yes. So
he thought I was a cop.
Yeah, he wasn't certain, but he felt like he might have spotted a fed there, and yeah.
When I told Barentine about the DNA results, he'd sounded momentarily stunned. Then he told me about how this case had been one of the last things still tying him to the past. One of the last things that had still been unresolved.
We say he got emotional about this. Did he, like, so, like, really emotional? Like, he didn't cry or anything?
No, nothing like that. He was just, I mean, he just sounded like surprised and kind of blown back, and I didn't think he'd talk to me, but when I told him that, he got much more chatty, and he was just like, I've always, and then he was like, my cousin did this thing online, DNA testing, and showed his cousins everywhere, like, why couldn't they have just done that sooner, why couldn't they have done this years ago, and spared me all this trouble, and I'm like, it's complicated, but wrong kind of DNA.
Huh.
Barentine told me that he felt very glad for Dennis Perry, and that he hoped Dennis Perry's lawyers could finally now do something to help him, now that he's proven his innocence. For his part, Barentine said, he's always wondered about whether Dennis was actually guilty or not, but he just never knew enough to say one way or the other.
So it seemed like this case had really played a big role in his life, you know?
Yeah, that's what he kept. He's just like, it's been my whole life I've been dealing with this. And you know, I mean, I still have questions there, for sure. But whatever happened, I mean, this is something that has been dogging him his entire life.
As for Dennis Perry, well, he remains in prison, awaiting a day when some court somewhere is able to hold hearings on his claims. That is not, by the way, a result that was inevitable, or some unfortunate side effect of the whole pandemic situation. Glynn County District Attorney Jackie Johnson stated recently in an interview with the Brunswick News that Dennis's attorneys at Georgia Innocence Project and King and Spalding had informed her of the DNA results before they filed anything in the court. If she had believed that these results warranted Dennis's conviction being overturned, she could have made that happen. Since she did not do that, and instead seems to believe that Dennis deserves to remain in prison while COVID-19 rages through Georgia's inmate population, it seems likely that the state of Georgia intends to oppose Dennis's extraordinary motion for a new trial. In past cases, Georgia prosecutors have sometimes responded to exculpatory DNA evidence that identifies an alternate suspect by revising their entire theory of the case and claiming that the reason for this new DNA is that actually there were two perpetrators all along, the defendant they originally convicted and also whoever it was whose DNA was all over the crime scene. So, in the hopefully unfounded expectation that something like that could happen here, I'm just going to go ahead and note now, for the record, that I have never encountered a shred of evidence in this case that would lend support to such a claim here. And any theory along those lines would be nothing more than prosecutor fan fiction. For now, though, Dennis will remain behind bars for 20 years and counting. But the investigation into the Swain case is far from over. And Josh, over at the AJC, still has plenty more to share.
But yeah, I can tell you that in the next few weeks, I can't swear to a release date because that often has backfired on me. But in the next few weeks, I have a rather lengthy and exhaustive story coming out about the case and about, you know, all of the crazy, some of the crazy things that happened to me while I was looking into the case and also touching on some of undisclosed findings and and a lot about Harold and Thelma Swain and how this case has haunted so many people for so many years. I wanted to accomplish a lot with the long story. I wanted to be able to tell people a lot about the emotions that are involved in it, you know, the grief and the disappointment in, you know, people like Kennedy and Gregory for how the case has ended up. And but I also wanted to try to add something, like I said, add something new to the discussion. And I think, where the big story does that is goes into a lot more detail about Spar and, you know, my interactions with Spar and the things that that he told me and the things that I learned.
As developments continue in Dennis's case, we'll be here to keep you updated every step of the way. Next time on Undisclosed. Thanks for listening to the special episode of Season 3 of Undisclosed, The Case Against Dennis Perry. Audio production for this episode is by Hannah McCarthy, and our executive producer is Methil Telhan. As always, thank you to our sponsors who make it possible for us to do this. And if you'd like, you can support us at our Patreon, or follow us on Twitter and Instagram at UndisclosedPod, and on Facebook at UndisclosedPodcast. You can find transcripts for this and every episode on our website, prepared by our fabulous transcript team, Erica Fladell, Don Logus, Britta Bliss, and Skylar Park. And if you'd like to support the work of the Georgia Innocence Project, you can donate at georgiainnocenceproject.org. Your donations make it possible for them to do the tireless work they do on behalf of Dennis Perry, Joey Watkins, and the many other wrongfully convicted defendants that they represent.